You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In March, the New America Foundation reported that the amount of debt graduate students are taking on is rising. Many of them invest years and thousands of dollars hoping to find a tenure-track position at a reputable university. But universities are decreasing the number of those positions available. And last year, the New York Times reported that tenure-track positions made up only 24% of the academic workforce. Rebecca Schumann, the education columnist at Slate, has written extensively on the perils of the academic job market, as well as on the culture and controversies of higher education and the humanities. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show now and invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Rebecca, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Many people unsatisfied with their jobs or uncertain about where to work wonder if they should go to graduate school to study what they love. What would you say to someone saying that to you?
Well, I mean, I would say, if you would be okay coming back to exactly the job that you left to go to graduate school, if it would even be there for you and that wouldn't be tragic to you, then go for it. If you are okay with really getting nothing out of graduate school other than the intellectual rewards and a couple more gray hairs and several years of your life being donated to that cause, then sure. But if you're going to do it because you want to actually join, especially in the humanities and social sciences, if you want to actually join the academic world as a professor, I think it's very important to realize that those jobs are not particularly good now. Most professor jobs are part-time and very poorly paid with no benefits and very little respect.
Did you have any career goals other than to teach on a college level? Are you regretting that you went to graduate school?
You know, that's an interesting question because I really like my job now as education columnist for Slate, and I wouldn't be able to do that job if I didn't have the doctorate. The doctorate opened a lot of doors for me, but in a very non-traditional and unexpected way. Shortly after I finished the doctorate, maybe in the 4 years that I was looking for an academic job, I regretted it immensely, especially as I got older and I realized I'd been putting off really important milestones that most people in their mid-30s have, like getting married, having children. I wasn't able to do that because I had to live separately from my partner, who's now my spouse. I always wanted to be a writer until my late 20s, and then I did get the sort of fever to go to graduate school, and the whole time I was in graduate school, I really did want to be quite badly a professor, just really wanted to dedicate my whole life to it.
Well, I'd ask you what kind of advice you would give. What kind of advice did you receive from your advisor or other professors? Were they realistic about the chances of finding a tenure-track position when you graduated?
No. I mean, some were and some weren't. So to be fair to them, when I began graduate school, it was 2005, and the job market in my field wasn't robust, but it existed. And nobody could have predicted the way in which the job market in the academic humanities just absolutely cratered in 2008 and never recovered. People thought that it was going to be a one-year or a two-year sort of lack of jobs and that universities would bring their tenure lines back once the money came back. But instead, they sort of took a page out of the corporate book and realized that these austerity measures were really good for their bottom line. And so the tenure lines went away and they never came back. I had my younger faculty members who had recently been on the job market did tell me, look, there are no jobs. It's going to be terrible. And, but the ones who had been, and they're not, I mean, I love them as people. They just sort of hadn't been looking for a job for years. I mean, they would tell me what most graduate students get told, which is there are no guarantees, but good people get jobs. Just work hard, just publish, just do what you're supposed to do and something will work out.
And, of course, that's not always the case. Some universities like Johns Hopkins are reducing the number of graduate student positions. Should other universities also consider admitting fewer grad students?
Absolutely. And any university, you know, all the people who are advocating, no, make the programs bigger and just train them for other careers, these are all people who are lifetime tenured academics who have not had to worry about having a job in 30 years, if ever. All the people who want to make graduate programs bigger basically want to make them bigger because their jobs depend on graduate enrollment. It's infuriating to me and to all of the adjunct professors out there making $14,000 a year. Every single field should say, look, our hiring rate is X. You know, if you're, and by hiring rate, I mean tenure track, good full-time job. If your field is hiring out at less than, I think, 70%, the entire field should either drastically reduce or eliminate graduate admissions until the field thins out a little bit. And I'm not talking about individual programs so that the only programs left are these elitist Ivy League programs. I'm talking about top to bottom, whole fields need to look in the mirror and say, look, we don't have the jobs to give these people right now, and so we shouldn't be inviting them into a life that doesn't exist. It's extraordinarily irresponsible to keep admitting people into graduate programs to lead. It's basically just leading them to the slaughter.
When professors retire or move on, doesn't that open up spots for new hires?
That's what we're told. Oh, the retirements are coming. But, and departments want, it's not the department's fault. It's not the professor's fault. It really isn't. Even, you know, the department chairs, even the people high up, they want very badly to replace that tenure line, and they apply for it with the university, and more often than not these days the university says no. Because why should they? If they can just get an adjunct to do it for one-tenth of the cost with no benefits and no commitment to that person, there's no reason for them to open an, to keep a tenure line open. So, and now at this point, older professors are holding on to their jobs for dear life, and they're going to stay in them until they pass away because they know that that tenure line is going to die with them.
But tuition prices continue to rise. Why doesn't that money go to into hiring more professors?
That is a fascinating question, Leonard, and I wish I knew the answer. To be honest with you, I have no idea where the money goes. I mean, some people say it goes to a growing administrative class, like lots of provosts and vice deans and executive deans.
And professors, the president's making millions of dollars in some cases.
In some cases, yes. Sometimes it goes to athletic programs that aren't profitable. Sometimes it goes to amenities that schools now say they need to provide to be competitive, like rock climbing walls and luxurious dorms. It's pretty funny because I went to, you know, I'm a graduate of Vassar College. That's where I did my undergrad, which is not a, you know, it's a very expensive small liberal arts school. But when I went there in the 90s, the dorms were very basic, and we didn't really have any sort of, there were no luxury amenities. The luxury amenities was the education. It was the school. And nowadays, there's a lot of, oh, our students are customers, and we need to provide this great customer experience for them. And so in the public school sphere, there still is, you can pay provosts and presidents a lot of money, but even if you didn't, there still wouldn't be enough for instruction, because the fact is that there's just a funding gap. There's a public funding gap. The public used to fund public universities, and now it doesn't.
My guest is Rebecca Schumann, who's education columnist for Slate. Doesn't departmental politics sometimes play a role in who does or who doesn't get a tenured professorship? Isn't that another problem?
It really varies from department to department. Every department across every discipline, sciences, you know, Nobel Prize winning science departments have great people. They have difficult people to work with. Yes, sometimes the department will have leadership, senior professorship that doesn't get along well with the administration, and that can cause problems when you want another tenure line, indeed. It can cause your department to go into receivership, which basically means that you're on double secret probation, to quote Animal House, and that the universe, like the administration, runs your department from the outside. Sometimes you just get, you know, basically blackballed from ever asking for a tenure line again, but you have to be pretty difficult to get along with for that to happen. I wouldn't place the blame on, I think that the vast majority of academic departments are doing their very, very best to keep afloat and to try to educate their students.
On the level below higher education, tenure has become a big issue, but can't it also be a problem in universities, professors who are not doing a good job or causing other kinds of problems, but who can't be gotten rid of because they have tenure?
Yeah, I mean, you can get rid of a professor with tenure. It can be done, especially if they've actually done something quite bad. There is something to be said about larger elite research-based universities basing their tenure decisions almost entirely on research and not really placing that much emphasis on teaching, especially teaching undergraduates. I think a lot of, including the faculty themselves, a lot of people working in higher ed would really love to see a shift back toward undergraduate instruction at all levels. But I think that the idea that, like, tenured, as soon as you get tenure, you stop writing new lectures and you just come in with, like, your faded yellowed notes and just speak from rote and you don't care about your students, I think that's a myth. And the vast majority of professors with tenure I know just work harder because they have other things that they want. They want to be promoted to full professor. They want better service commitments. You might have some job security as a tenured professor, but you're never really safe. And so I would say that most tenured professors are still busting their humps pretty hard.
Does publish or perish still hold true?
Absolutely, and it's gone. It's mayhem, Leonard. It's insane. I mean, if you just look at me, I never even got a tenure-track job, and I have, like, a big, long list of peer-reviewed publications. I have a book coming out, and this was just, like, barely enough to get me interviews to get a job. The level of publications that somebody like me has 10, 15, 20 years ago would have gotten tenure. Could be promoted, you know, even to full professor back in the 60s and 70s. These days, I call it publish and perish because everybody just publishes this torrent of stuff that everybody's too busy writing to read. Nobody reads anything anymore because there's just too much of it. There was a recent study done that over half of all academic publications in every discipline, sciences, social sciences, humanities, has exactly three readers, and that's the author and the two peer reviewers that the editor and the journal sent it to. And so everybody has to publish to get their career off, but nobody reads what, because everybody has to do too much. You know, the guy that invented the Higgs boson, or who, you know, discovered the Higgs boson particle says, look, I wouldn't get tenure in today's university. It's too much. Everybody agrees that it's too much. I have no idea why it has gotten to this stage of total madness, but it's mayhem.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the differential between adjunct professors and full-time professors. We'll talk about student evaluations, about sleeping with your students, all sorts of interesting things. And we invite our listeners who have had experience along these lines to give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guest is Rebecca Schumann. She's the education columnist for Slate. We're back with Rebecca Schumann, who's the education columnist for Slate. Invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us online at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. How is the position of an adjunct professor different from a full-time professor? What's the pay differential?
I'm so glad that you asked that, Leonard, because a lot of people, you know, they hear the word professor and they assume that's a professional job. I mean, they have the same root word. It really depends on your area and also your discipline, the geographic area, I mean. So a full-time tenure-track professor will start at the assistant professor level at a salary from anywhere from, you know, about $40,000 a year all the way up to the low six figures if it's a very, very fancy science or business field. So it's, you know, it's a middle class salary.
So that's at variance to something I read in 2012. The Chronicle of Higher Education reported on a number of adjunct professors who relied on food stamps and welfare.
Yeah, that's the full-time tenure-track professor salary that I just gave you.
Uh-huh.
So adjunct professors, on average, in this country make $2,700 per course. and teach, you know, anywhere from one to three or four or even seven or eight at different universities courses per semester. When I was an adjunct, I made about $18,000 a year, and I taught at a school that paid adjuncts pretty well. Most adjuncts I know usually make around $20,000 to $25,000 a year, and that includes in cities that are expensive. And so, yes, many adjuncts, and they receive no benefits, no health insurance, nothing a full-time employee would get. Often they receive no office space. Often they receive no supplies of any sort. Often they even don't even get an email address or are not allowed to affiliate officially with the university. That's rare, but it does happen. And so they're not listed usually on the department's website under faculty in the course catalog. When you're registering for a class that's taught by an adjunct, it will just say staff. It won't say their name. And so there are monetary differences between adjunct faculty and full-time faculty. They're very, very severe. And then there are also psychological differences and simply just personal differences on campus.
Graduate students at some universities have tried to unionize. Do you think that's a good idea? And would that be possible for adjunct professors?
Absolutely. And there's a nationwide drive under the banner Adjunct Action doing that right now. Adjunct Action is affiliated with the Service Employees International Union, and they're working very hard going from city to city, holding symposia and different events to reach out to adjuncts, learn about their lives, learn about what money they're making and what they want. And many, many adjuncts all around the country are currently voting to collectivize as we speak, and that can only help them.
We have a university chair on the line, Andrew from the Lower East Side. Hi.
Hello. I'm a tenured professor. I chair a Department of Liberal Arts SUNY school.
Who did you have to pay off to get that job?
Well, frankly, nobody else wanted the job. Chairs can sometimes be powerful, but quite often they're kind of middlemen with no budgets and very little power. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of happy to get the status, but at the same time, it's not a very powerful position in a lot of departments and a lot of schools. But the point I wanted to raise for discussion was at my school, the administration would like us to hire a second tier of professors, full-time professors as full-time instructors and full-time lecturers who'd be paid less, would teach one more course a semester. I don't want to hire more adjuncts to teach. These full-time instructor-lecturer jobs are better than a freelance adjunct, so I know they'd be happy to take that job. But at the same time, I, you know, desperately want to hold on to the tenured lines, but they're not going to come with SUNY budget cuts and lowering enrollments because of the demographics of people coming out of high school. There aren't as many students coming out of high school right now. So he looks at that and says, less people to enroll, not going to hire any more full-time tenured professors.
Is that in the humanities or in all areas?
Humanities, mostly, but in all areas. I mean, the number of high school graduates affects every department. Clearly, some departments are, more attractive than others, and SUNY's making a big push on STEM. And also, to your guest's first point, until recently, they were very big on increasing the number of graduate programs. There was a lot of pressure put on us to develop graduate programs because SUNY reimbursed the college at a higher rate for graduate students. So it made economic sense not to develop undergraduate programs to attract more undergraduates because we'd get less money from SUNY than we would if we developed a graduate program. So there was an economic incentive to increase the number of graduate programs.
Andrew, thank you so much for calling us. Do you want to add anything to that, Rebecca, before I move on to another call? Because we're getting some great calls.
I want to thank him for being one of the good ones and just keep fighting the fight. I agree in what you say about the perils of hiring full-timers, but I do think it's for adjuncts like me, it's better than a poke in the butt with a sharp stick. And so I say anybody you can give a full-time job to, do your best to do it. But keep fighting the fight. You sound like one of the good ones.
Barbara, who's the president of a union?
Good morning. Yes, I'm president of the Union of Adjunct Faculty at Pace University in Lower Manhattan.
And so there are unions now. What does the union get for the adjunct professors?
Well, the first thing that we got for the adjunct professor was minimum salaries. What we found when we first began to unionize, the dichotomy between those at the top end who were making something like $1,700 a credit and those at the bottom level who were making $300 and $400 was huge. We also found that there were instances where people with the same amount of years of service, the same educational background, were making vastly disparate salaries. For example, two people in science, both with PhDs, both 34 years experience. One made over $1,700, one made around $800. So I guess just getting adjuncts to be aware of how badly they were paid was a major step forward. And we did institute minimum salaries. And
what kind of pushback did you get from the administration?
Oh, the administration has fought every step of the way and they're still fighting. Just as an example, New York City just instituted the paid sick leave law. So there's a loophole in it that says that if you have an existing labor contract, you don't have to do it. Well, we have a labor contract, and it denies sick leave for your first 2 years of employment. So I asked the president to waive the loophole and give everybody the sick leave. And I was told, no, they couldn't do that. And besides, they really didn't have to because the law only applied in New York City and they have a campus in Pleasantville. So the Pleasantville people don't need to get it.
Barbara, I have to move on to another call, but I'm not surprised by any of this.
No, but just let me end. Rebecca's right about the $2,700 per adjunct average salary, but if you're unionized, it goes up to $3,100. So go union.
Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye.
We have Vincent from New Jersey on the line. Hi, Vincent.
Hello, Leonard. I'm an adjunct at a small Catholic college in New Jersey, and adjuncts there are paid $600 per credit, so $1,800 before taxes for a three-credit course. And we are limited to only teaching two courses per semester, four for the entire year. So the top salary that we can make is $7,200. Also, from a student point of view, they're cheated, really, because we do not have offices. We do not have phones. So office hours and advisement happen in the hallway before or after class.
Do you have to deal with student evaluations?
Students do rate us at the end of the class, yes.
Because,
but that is voluntary on the student's part.
Rebecca, how are student evaluations weighed for adjunct professors?
It depends. It varies from institution to institution, but at many institutions, it's the only thing that that will get them rehired. Where I have taught as an adjunct, it was the sole determining factor about whether you were brought back.
And you have written that student evaluations are useless.
I think that they are currently very flawed in their present state, yes.
You have anything to add, Vincent, before I move on?
Our evaluations don't really count towards being hired or rehired. However, I guess if you had a really horrible evaluation, you wouldn't be asked back. But no administrator ever watches us teach or evaluates our teaching methods at all.
Thank you so much for calling us. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with Rebecca Schumann, who is the education columnist for Slate. You write about the culture of professors and graduate students becoming romantically involved. How common is that?
more common than anyone likes to admit.
And are the teachers generally punished for that kind of activity?
No, absolutely not. almost always the relationship is kept as an open secret. It's sort of under wraps, and it can end, if it ends badly, it usually ends badly for the student, and the professor just goes on living, sometimes her, but usually his life. And, you know, his colleagues know that this professor is in a sort of an inveterate student romancer and kind of just look the other way if he does good work. That's kind of the status quo. And some fields are worse than others. I'm always picking on philosophy, but it happens to be one of the worst ones. And, you know, there are many departments where everybody is really outstanding and great, including the one that I graduated from. But professors either from being involved with graduate students or wanting to be involved with graduate students is a major issue in academia.
Talking about philosophy departments, there was a report in February about sexual misconduct and an environment unfriendly to women at the University of Colorado that's Boulder in its philosophy department. Why was the situation so bad at Boulder? Or is it more typical than we'd like to believe?
According to my colleagues at a great blog called Feminist Philosophers, there are many departments that are a lot like Boulder's. It's just that a lot of people filed official Title IX complaints and clery at Boulder, and that university happened to have been in a little bit of a couple other pickles with some Title IX issues. And so they made the decision to commission an outside committee to come in and observe for a while and write a report. And so it's not so much that that department was worse than any other department. It just happened to be the first one to have a report of its kind, sort of detailing, without naming anybody, what had happened.
And do we have any idea why philosophy departments in particular? Is it have anything to do with Immanuel Kant or...
Yeah, blame it all on Kant. I'd be happy doing that. I'm not a fan. My husband is a Kant expert, so I hope he's not listening, or else it's going to be a rough.
That Nietzsche, he really caused trouble. That Wittgenstein, he was... okay, anyway, one listener writes on Twitter, grad school pays me to research with no other 9-to-5 job. This is a huge privilege, regardless of future professional success. So that's the other side of the story, isn't it? Or one of the other sides?
Sure. And good for you. If you like it, then have a great time. I would say I thought that too about 7 or 8 years ago. And you might feel differently when you emerge and you're in your late 30s and all of your friends have established careers and families and you're just beginning and there's nothing for you to do. And it's very difficult for you to find a non-academic job because everybody wonders why you're 37 and you don't have any relevant recent experience. I would ask this person to talk to me again in 5-6 years and see how it's going.
Another listener wrote on our show page, the fact is that there's an oversupply of teachers, so the market works its magic.
Ugh, I wish that listener could see me rolling my eyes. The capitalist argument about this is not an argument. Yes, okay, supply and demand, but that doesn't justify treating human beings poorly. Walmart workers don't deserve to be paid as little as they are just because they're willing to take those jobs. Under no circumstances should anybody in the world, any worker in the world, be paid less than what they're worth. I mean, I realize that makes me sound like an inveterate pinko, but I get really annoyed with the supply and demand argument because that doesn't justify treating people badly.
You wrote an article called Confession of a Grade Inflator. Why do you inflate your students' grades? And isn't this common these days? A student comes to you and says, I'm paying big bucks to be at this school, and you're giving me a C. It's going to ruin all of my prospects for the future?
I don't know. When my students get a C, it's because they probably should have gotten an F. Like, when my students get a C, it's a Murphy C, and so I usually get some effusive thanks. You know, it depends on each institution. I taught at an honors college where there really was a culture of high achievement, and so students really did do everything that they were supposed to do. And, you know, the criteria for what earns a certain grade is just a lot looser than it was even 10 years ago, I was not in college 10 years ago, 20 years ago when I was in college.
Yeah, I could have been an A student if I'd gone to school now. instead of a C student.
They have to invent a new letter for you, Leonard.
You also have written about the study abroad scam at universities. How many study abroad programs are scamming students?
Oh, my gosh, I wouldn't even know because there hasn't been an investigation. But there's definitely an explosion of private for-profit study abroad programs, and many, many schools are really tempted to affiliate with them because it means that they can outsource all of the work. And so if a student, I would highly recommend study abroad. I studied abroad twice in college, and then I was a Fulbright scholar in graduate school. Best experience possible. But if at all possible, I would make sure to go to a study abroad program that's developed in-house by your university, by your university's home faculty.
We're going to give the last word to somebody who's been an administrator at a number of schools. Gail from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. You've been the president and dean at two universities?
Dean at two universities and president at one.
Uh-huh. So are your ears burning from this conversation?
Actually, I'm very supportive of the issue of the adjuncts and the underpay of the adjuncts. I know we had to use large numbers of adjuncts in all of the universities at which I was an administrator, but in part that's because many of the tenured faculty taught so little. I'm all for tenure in terms of free speech, and I'm all for intellectual activity that the reduced teaching load that tenured professors have is an aid of. The problem is there are many professors who did not do any research that was of worth, yet only taught maybe two or three courses a semester. And as a consequence, we had to hire adjuncts. And many of these tenured professors were paid in the range of $100,000 to $120,000 a year for what was essentially 8 months of quote-unquote full-time work, and then 4 months off in the summertime where they were supposed to be doing research. But I can tell you that in many cases, the quality of the research was worthless. And I think that's the core of the problem, is the way the system is set up with the tenured professors then forces you to hire adjuncts, and the budget doesn't leave that much left to pay the adjuncts.
Rebecca, we've run out of time. Do you want to jump in on this?
I just think that that's a really fascinating angle. We don't usually get that down in the muck where I live, and so I think that that will give my readers and your listeners a lot to think about.
Gail, thank you so much for calling in.
I'm a traitor to my class, I presume.
And Rebecca, thank you so much for being on our show. Rebecca Schumann, who is the education columnist for Slate. It's always fun reading your columns. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for reading. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, some of us still read.